UK Wine Show, show number 204. Tim Heath and Siobhan Harnett on Reduction in Wine. Hello and welcome to this week's UK Wine Show, on the week that we say goodbye to Hong Kong and hello New Zealand. In fact, we're off to Marlborough, where I'm interviewing Tim Heath, he's the winemaker at Cloudy Bay, and Siobhan Harnett, she's the viticulturist down there. We're going to be finding out what causes reduction in wine, how climate conditions can create it, and also we get a bit geeky on what it looks like and how it's created in the winery. So, for those of you who like the techie shows, this is definitely one of the shows for you. Don't worry though, if you're not techie, you should be able to follow the show. Tim and Siobhan make it very easy to understand, but they do go into a bit of detail, and I really like it. Back home in Twickenham, we've had a lot of planes fly over our heads over the last few days. Thankfully, nothing today while I'm recording the show, because it makes for a very frustrating recording. On Wednesday night, the Heathrow flight started up, and we got a terrible night's sleep with planes flying over time and time again. I suppose that's one of the joys of living in West London. It may be nice, but the plane, Mr. Rock. No, you probably didn't see Fantasy Island when you were kids. Anyway, let's crack on with the show. I went to the English wine trade tasting today as well. Had a bit of a problem. I've got a bit of a blocked up nose, and I've been taking Sudafed, which is a nasal spray. And I tell you what, talk about interfering with your palate. I could smell the wines, but everything had this intense acidic lemon finish. Certainly not enjoyable. I get a vague idea of what's going on, but you just had to ignore the finish of the wine. Did a couple of interviews as well. I've got an interview with Mike Roberts from Ridgeview, one of my favourite wines, and tried one of his sparkling red wines. He's made it from Pinot Noir. Quite an interesting wine, enjoyable. Probably I like it more than some of the Aussie Shirazes. A lot more expensive than the Aussie sparkling Shirazes, but definitely a surprising wine anyway. I also interviewed Joe from Wickham Vineyards. They are the people who bought 14 of the Threshers stores. Remember when Threshers collapsed a wee while ago? Wickham Vineyards bought 14 of them, so we find out about what they're doing and why they've purchased them. And finally, I did an interview with Stanlake Park. They're one of the first wineries as part of this new revival mode of the last 20 years of UK viticulture. So quite a good range of podcasts there. We'll be releasing them over the next 2 or 3 months as well. But let's crack on with this week's show. We're going to start off with our mystery grape variety. Now, a mystery grape variety is a sensitive grape that buds early, demands good exposure to the sun, and it's the reason it's often on the southwest hills. It also prefers calcareous and marl soils. It produces a deep-coloured, high alcohol wine, stridently high tannins and acidity and dry extract. However, with careful winemaking and extensive aging, for sure, it can be a wonderful aromatic complexity of full flavour, reminiscent of violets and tar. That should give it away to some of you guys, which is balanced by both tannins and acidity. As normal, I'm going to give the answer at the end of the show and the second clue just before the interview and just after the news, which is just coming up next with Jane.
Cheers, Chris. A report by Food and Agribusiness Bank, Rabobank, has shown that the process of removing vineyards to reduce Australia's oversupply of grapes is slow and falling short of the 20% reduction, or 30,000 hectares, that the Australian Wine and Brandy Corporation and other trade bodies had estimated was needed to bring supply into balance with demand. According to analysts, the pace of vineyard removal in the temperate climate, that's the cooler regions, where the supply-demand imbalance is most acute, have been particularly slow. In these regions, vineyard owners might have stronger non-farming income and better resources to survive in the long term. It's estimated that 8,000 hectares of vineyards were likely to be removed in the 2009-10 period, but that three quarters were in the warm inland irrigated regions, where growers' profits have been affected by drought and growers had less income from sources unrelated to farming.
What's the next story, Jane?
Well, over to the United States, a bill that could stop wineries from selling direct to consumers if it goes through is being opposed by wine producers and congressmen who represent California's key wine districts. The bill is being backed by the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of America, the WSWA, which is a lobby for distributors. At the end of Prohibition in 1933, the Constitution's 21st Amendment gave each state full control over regulating alcohol inside its borders. But the Commerce Clause gave Congress the power to regulate commerce between the states. And in 2005, a ruling was made that each state must allow out-of-state wineries to ship directly to customers if their own state wineries did the same. These sales bypass the regulatory three-tier system under which producers must sell to middlemen who then sell to retailers. In the words of the WSWA, the aim of the new legislation is to ensure that states retain their constitutional power to regulate the distribution of alcoholic beverages and are able to fend off litigation which could serve to destabilise or destroy that authority.
You may recall last week I commented on the New York wine scene in a reasonably favourable terms. Interesting range, diversity of styles. Part of the reason it works is this complex three-tier system. The downside is that it creates opportunities to block access to some markets. Let's face it, you're a middle-of-the-road Napa or Sonoma County producer, and how many wholesalers are there in each state to actually take your wines? So there's a significant risk that as a supplier, you may not be able to get access to the markets if you can't sell direct. But by selling wine interstate, the state that the wine ends up in also loses tax revenue. So you can see why some are keen to stop it and why California is desperate to keep it. From tax to global warming, what's the last story, Jane?
Well, back over to the other side of the world again. Villa Maria and Paliza Estate are the first wineries to achieve Certified Emissions Measurement and Reduction Scheme, or CEMARS, certification in New Zealand. The scheme represents the first two steps of the internationally recognised Carbon Zero programme that enables businesses to measure their greenhouse gas emissions, understand their carbon liabilities, and put in place plans to reduce their emissions. The wineries were two of just 10 New Zealand businesses to be accredited. That's it from me this week. Don't forget these stories are on our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. I have an interview with Anne Smith from Landcare, who was part of the people that set up the Carbon Zero scheme, and I'll be releasing that show later on in the year. As with these schemes, they're a progressive approach to minimising the environmental impact. They're not there to do it straight away. It's more about making sure you measure, understand and then mitigate the issues. Okay, what's coming up next? Well, next up we've got our spotlight. And this week's spotlight is looking at wine glasses and stemware. And it doesn't matter whether you drink from a flute or a bucket. There is no doubt that the glass you use will change your emotional and sensory pleasure that you get from the contents. The three parts to wine tasting, seeing, smelling and tasting, are enhanced by the correct stemware. And in response to this, there's a huge variety of glasses that are advocated by various glass manufacturers. You can have your Sauvignon Blanc, your Shiraz, your Cool Climate Savvy, your Warm Climate Savvy, your Big Cabernet, your Small Cabernet. You name it, there's a glass for everything. And many manufacturers, such as Riedel, base their designs on a now disproven view that we taste wine in different parts of our mouths. They advocate that acidity is sensed on the sides of the tongue, bitterness towards the back. And although it's been known for some time that acidity and bitterness are sensed all over the tongue, the belief is wines in high acidity should be shot to the back of the throat, avoiding the acidity receptors on the sides, and tannic wines should be kept away from the back and towards the front of the mouth, where the bitterness receptors are. And for those of you who, like me, you get the wine in, you swish it around your mouth, coating all the areas and then swallowing it, this may appear a bit silly. The manufacturers of glass respond to this by saying that the brain is lazy. The first impression really counts much more, so hitting and avoiding the right parts of the tongue is key. And to be honest, while the science is flawed, I have tasted wine in various glasses, and it does make the difference. And, strangely enough, they seem to be about right. I'm not quite sure why, but I know the science is flawed that they use, but the results seem to work. Go figure. If you look at a glass, it's made up of a base and stem, a bowl, and then the rim. And the most important part of a glass is the bowl and the walls of the glass. A good shape for a wine glass is an egg with its top cut off. It has a large bowl with the sides that taper up to the top. The tapered sides, they look similar to a closed tulip. Stop the wine from coming out when you swirl it. There's nothing worse than swirling a glass and getting red wine all over your top. But they also concentrate the aroma of the wine. The larger the bowl, the less tipping back of the head is required, and because of that, the slower the wine will leave, not hitting the back of the tongue at where the tannic sensors are, according to the glass manufacturers, although I disagree. Helpfully, tannic wines often improve with a bit of oxidation as well, and a larger bowl will allow a lot of oxygen to get into the wine, particularly if they swirl the glass. It's a bit like a decanter. Decanters have a large surface area to encourage oxygen interacting with the wine. The rim is the second most important part. From an aesthetic point of view, a lot of people believe that cut polished rims with no discernible lip on them are the best, as it allows the wine to gently tipple into the mouth. However, these glasses do tend to break quite easily. They certainly make a more aesthetic glass, but they're also more expensive to make, so these glasses are more expensive than the cheaper rims with a wee rolled lip on the top. The smaller the aperture of the rim, the less room the wine aromas have to escape, therefore concentrating the smell of the aroma. Again, strangely enough, acidic wines often taste better on wines with a small opening that tip the wine to the back of the mouth, avoiding the sides. Don't know why, science isn't proven, but it seems to be correct. The stem and the base, the last two parts of the wine, are mainly for aesthetics rather than functionality, but the stem does isolate the bowl from your hands. And a short, stubby stem can mean that you'll end up touching the bowl with your hands, warming or cooling the bowl, depending on whether it's a red wine or a white wine. So long stems are nicer, they're more elegant, but they do tend to snap, and I've snapped quite a few stems in my time. That finishes what I really wanted to say at the moment about glassware. I am going to expand on this later on. We'll have a good look at champagne flutes, and there's all sorts of weird things that people have been doing with champagne flutes over the years. But next up, we're going to give our second clue in our mystery wine grape variety. As we said earlier, the grape variety has high tannins and high acidity. So from a wine glass point of view, we're looking for a wine with a big bowl and a very, very small aperture or opening at the top. There are a debate about the origins of the wine, with theories varying from the word coming from noble or from nebbia, which is Italian for fog. The latter seems most likely, since fog shrouds Piedmont hills around October, where these late ripening grapes are harvested. It is also the black grape variety that brings us the finest and long-lived Italian wines. Native to Piedmont in the northwest, it's the grape that makes the top category DOCG wines of Barolo, Barbaresco. That's the last clue. I'll give you the name of the grape variety at the very end of the show, but next up we have our interview with Tim Heath and Siobhan Harnett. Tim's the winemaker at Cloudy Bay, and Siobhan is the viticulturalist. We had Siobhan on the show about 2 years ago, talking about viticulture in Cloudy Bay. And this week, we're going to be talking about reduced flavours in wine, where they come from the vineyard, through the winemaking process, and how to deal with them. I found this interview really interesting, and for those of you who likes the more geeky, sciencey shows, I hope this satisfies your want. Let's have a listen to what Tim and Siobhan have to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Siobhan Harnett and Tim Heath. Siobhan's the viticulturalist at Cloudy Bay, and Tim is the winemaker. How are you guys?
Very well, thanks.
Very good, thanks.
What we're going to do is we're going to talk quickly about nitrogen and reduction, and we're also going to touch on a wee bit of maybe about wine cellar footwear.
No, we're not.
But you've got a nice set of gumboots.
They are pretty flash, nice and warm and snuggly.
Okay.
Good for this time of year.
I might pick some up later on. So let's talk a wee bit about viticulture and what the issues are. But Tim, just briefly, reduction in the grapes, what is the key issue from a winemaking? So what should we be looking for in the vineyard?
I guess there's a multi-level sort of thing, but it really all starts out in the vineyard to a certain degree, and that's the level of nitrogen that the fruit actually contains, and the yeast use that nitrogen as food during fermentation. So if there's a shortage of that food in the grapes to begin with, then we can run into some issues further down the track.
All right, well, let's talk to Siobhan about that. If it's nitrogen, where does the nitrogen come from?
Ammonium, it can be in many forms, and for a very short time it's plant available. It's not, there's not elemental nitrogen just lying around in the soil that's easily available. If you think back to probably when you were 13, 14 and you go through the nitrogen cycle, a lot of elemental nitrogen is just sitting in the atmosphere, the air we breathe. Vines can't actually use it, or plants can't use it. It's not plant available, that's the term.
Yep.
So it has to go through a cycle where it breaks down into different formats or forms that the plant can actually use. And interestingly, for an element to be taken up by a plant, it actually has to be dissolved in water. So, you know, plants are out there, or vines are out there, and they're actually drinking a broth or a weak soup of nutrients, and mm-hmm. that's how they take it up, and that's how they use it from there. Essentially, what vines do when they photosynthesize is they make sugar, which is made up of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen.
Yep.
But they also do make protein, and the difference there is that, you know, sugars or starches are carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. Proteins are carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen.
Oh, okay.
Juice is required to have a basic level of nitrogen there. Yeast that converts the sugar into alcohol needs to replicate itself, and the yeast coats are made of nitrogen, or protein, sorry. It's a working office, you can tell.
Yes. The reason I'm interested is because in the UK we're still running some 08 Sauvignon Blancs, and some of the wines, which, you know, won awards earlier on, you know, a year or so ago,
yeah.
are starting to become quite reductive.
Yeah.
You know, very sort of
pongy,
yeah. Mm, and it's not necessarily all the Sauvignon Blancs that are doing it.
Just some,
and it's also mainly Sauvignon Blanc. I've noticed. I haven't seen it in Riesling or any of the other grape varieties either.
True.
When you were growing the grapes in 08, was there anything you noticed?
Yes. What we are finding is summers, and particularly mid to late summer and autumn, where the natural rainfall is actually quite low. If we have a dry midsummer to autumn, what can happen over time is that the vines become increasingly reliant on the wetted strip of the irrigation, the little pipe that runs underneath them.
Yeah, I saw that on the way in. Yeah. There's a bit of water down there.
Exactly. We have to irrigate to have a consistent crop every year, because we're in deficit in Marlborough from about November often through to March, April.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to supplement the vines, because a lot of our vines on the valley floor, they sit in soil that's really free-draining. It doesn't hold a lot. So we have to assist them along with regular little waterings. And that wetted strip directly underneath the vines, that can actually get leached out of available nitrogen, because, as I said before, it has to go through its cycle to become released and become plant available. So the soil is doing its thing as much as possible. It's releasing as much as possible. But a great big vine becomes increasingly reliant on that little wetted strip. And it's like, you know, trying to give a cup of tea to 20 people on one tea bag.
Yeah.
It gets worked out. And what can happen if you're not onto it is that you, at the end of the season, your juice will come in and it will actually be quite depleted of available nitrogen. So you have to be quite vigilant, and you have to track it every year to see whether your levels are going up or down in your juice.
Have you ever thought, like, I understand legumes are nitrogen fixing.
That's right.
So have you, do people
yes,
run
they
legumes?
Do. Yep. And between the rows, in the middle of the rows, people will plant cover crops.
Yep.
Because legumes what they do is they grab that plant unavailable atmospheric nitrogen and they convert it into plant available forms. However, it's a good supplement. You still need a natural rainfall for the nitrogen in that middle row area for the roots of the vines to get out
through.
There to use it.
Yeah.
It's still, you know, it can be a meter and a half away.
Mm-hmm.
And the plants, you know, have to get there via a natural rainfall. And also it only builds up the levels very slowly. So you have to make sure that you're always keeping your vines within balance and not letting them get too depleted. So you have to, you basically have to measure and be quite vigilant. And you can use all those kind of tools.
What about partial
root zone
drying and all that sort of stuff? Is there things that you can do to encourage the vine to maybe get the nutrients from different parts of the root ball?
Yes and no. Sometimes you hear people say, oh, we don't do this because we want to force the roots down in. And,
I know.
Sometimes people can really anthropomorphize plants. They will do what's easiest. Roots, you know, for them to go right down deep into soil and at great depths in soil, it actually requires a whole lot of hydraulic force for them to do, and they'll just go where it's easiest. And for us in our climate here in Marlborough, we have 2 inches or 50 millimeters a month, roughly every month. We don't have a winter rainfall, or in a dry summer we have, you know, 50 mils every month. And so we are getting these occasional bursts of natural rainfall, and you know, vines know this, and they will hang around, and that within minutes of the topsoil being wet, they can send out these microscopic, very fine roots that actually make the most of it. And up on the root surface is where all the highly weathered soil, and when soil is weathered, it breaks down into tiny little bits.
Yep.
And when those tiny little bits get wet, they turn into a broth, which is of use to the vine. So yeah, roots will go where it's easy money. You know, they just want to get the job done.
And do you fertilize it all? Maybe you can put nitrogen in the water.
Yes, you can. You can fertigate, which is, you know, you can make your little soup and you can add the soup. You have to be quite careful on budgeting the amounts and how and when you put it in and how you put it. You don't want to
burn them off.
Exactly. Nitrogen, too little and too much. It can hurt you either way, so you don't want to sort of burn them off with too high a dose.
What do you see if there's too little nitrogen in the? Can you see it?
Yep, you see little leaves and you see yellow leaves.
Each
variety has a different shade of green. Chardonnay and Pinot Noir can sometimes be quite a yellow green.
Yep.
Sauvignon can be what I would call a blue green when it's healthy. So they will have their different shade of green, but basically you're looking for a fully expanded, a large, deep green working leaf. I call it a working leaf because it's a net producer of sugar.
Yep.
The leaf diameter will get smaller, they will get yellower.
And what about if they've got too much nitrogen?
You will have really big leaves, you'll have very large internodes, you will have very thick canes.
Any burning at the tips of the leaves or anything
like
that?
No, not with too much. Oh, if you actually, you know, go and apply too much nitrogen in whatever form, yeah, you will burn it off. It will look like a scald.
Okay. All right, then, Siobhan, I think we'll have a chat to Tim now about the winemaking process of nitrogen. So we've got the grapes, we've got some nitrogen in there, and they come into the cellar ready for you to do your stuff.
Yes.
And what happens, you know, do you measure it, or how do you? What do you do?
Yep, absolutely. So after receival of the fruit and the pressing operation, we'll take a sample of the juice from that particular vineyard block, and we will get one of our lab people to run an analysis and measure the amount of nitrogen that's available to yeast during fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually called YAN, Y-A-N, or yeast assimilable nitrogen.
Yep.
And what we want to see is a nice healthy level of that in the juice, because that ultimately, in really basic terms, means that we're going to have a nice, easily managed, healthy fermentation that remains really clean and it doesn't produce a lot of off aromas or reductive flavors, particularly hydrogen sulfide, which we don't want to see a lot of at all.
So if you've gotten not enough nitrogen, you get a hydrogen sulfide. Is that just the chemistry that goes on with yeast gobbling it up in a nitrogen?
Exactly. So if it's a really poor juice in terms of its nitrogen levels, the yeast are going to get in there, start multiplying. At the beginning of a ferment, it's a bit like a big yeast party. They're all having a good time. There's lots of sugar and nutrients, but they'll quickly eat all of those nutrients up, those nutrients being nitrogen mainly. And when they run out of that, they start to get really stressed. And as part of their biochemistry, I guess you could say, they will revert to making hydrogen sulfide in an attempt to re-uptake that hydrogen sulfide and then try and turn that into a source of nitrogen via another biochemical pathway. That's all pretty complex chemistry going on, or biochemistry. But ultimately, if you've got low nitrogen content in your juice, you can almost be assured that you're going to have issues with reduction.
Is there any particular grape varieties that are more susceptible? Because I've noticed Savvy seems to be the one that I really notice from the 08s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that there's any varieties in particular that are more prone to having lower nitrogen levels than others. I guess it may be related back to how vigorous the plant is. Sauvignon's quite vigorous. It likes to sort of grow a lot of sticks and leaves during the growing season and ripening season. So that's probably putting a bit of a load on the vine as far as its use of nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, that could possibly relate to lower nitrogen levels in the juice.
Do they get nitrogen from skin contact? For example, is there nitrogen in the skin? So when you're extracting tannins and colour, you get nitrogen?
Yep, there's lots of goodies in skins for yeast. There's a whole lot of different types of goodies, not only just nitrogen, but ultimately there's a reasonably even spread of nitrogen in the juice and also the skin. episode, but skin contacting will increase some of the levels of nutrients and other complex goodies for the yeast to use. But then that's also a compromise stylistically, because as you mentioned, you'll get more tannin pickup and a different flavor profile. So that's winemaking for you. There's lots of compromises. You do one thing and you think that you've solved something or other, and then you've actually got another problem in another area. So
yeah, you've got your juice in, you check your yang, it's a bit yin and yang sort of thing,
isn't it?
You check your yang and you find that, I haven't got enough nitrogen. So what do you do? Do you just pour in a bit of ammonia and away you go?
No, kind of, but not really. There's a couple of options, and one of them is to add something called DAP, which is used in many, many different countries around the world. And that is a source of nitrogen or ammonium for the yeast, and it looks a bit like a white granulated salt. And you mix that up in water and add, we're talking pretty small quantities here, add that to the fermentation. And that's a really readily available source of food for yeast. It's almost like junk food for yeast. Then the other option is to get a complex yeast food, which is derived from yeast themselves. It's a yeast extract.
Yep.
And that has a lot of really complex amino acids and proteins in there. And that's good. It takes them a while to eat that up, and it's like a long-lasting food. In a sense, it's a bit like the vegetables of the nitrogen world as far as additives go. So what we've found is a balanced approach between those two methods has given us the best results with keeping our ferments clean.
Yeah. Do you hold back yeast from the previous season, for example? You could use that yourself to reintroduce into if you find your yans out of balance.
No, that's a pretty complex job making yeast extract, best left to the experts. So no, we don't do that.
Okay. So you get your wine, you find that it's got a bit of low nitrogen, you adjust it up.
Yep.
You give it some fast food and maybe some broccoli or something.
That's it. Like hamburgers and vegetables at the same time.
Hamburgers and vegetables. And it comes through. But if you do get some of that hydrogen sulfate, is it hydrogen sulfate or hydrogen sulfide?
Sulfide.
I've heard people just copper the wine or they can strip it out.
Yep.
And what's that process going on there?
Okay, so that will bind the hydrogen sulfide and it will form an insoluble material and then fall to the bottom of the tank. So essentially remove all of that hydrogen sulfide that's in the wine. Definitely the best thing to be doing is to manage your ferments such that you don't have hydrogen sulfide there in the first place.
Well, what's the problem with just stripping it out later on?
Well, certainly I believe the less that you do to a wine, the better that it is. The more that you poke and prod and add things and tweak it up here and there, like I said before, there's always compromises to what you're doing. You may be fixing one problem, but then also doing damage to other important flavor compounds, and especially so in Sauvignon Blanc. All of the important flavor and aroma compounds in Sauvignon are actually sulfur-based. So if you're adding copper to remove hydrogen sulfide, which is sulfur-based, it will also start pulling out some of the good stuff too.
There's some methoxypyrazine.
These ones are called volatile thiols. There's also another family of compounds in Sauvignon called methoxypyrazines, which is responsible for the more herbal and grassy flavors. Whereas volatile thiols, the sulfur-based group of compounds that are important in Savvy, are responsible for flavors like passion fruit, grapefruit. Sometimes people talk about a boxwood character. Black currant, those kind of aromas, then in really, really high concentrations, they'll actually start to smell a bit like cat's pee or a sweaty armpit, which is not necessarily a nice thing, but some of that in your overall blend can be useful. But definitely the less copper you need to be adding to your wine to clean up sulfides, the better it is in terms of protecting that important group of compounds.
Okay. The last thing I'll just touch on is one of the wines that I'm noticing, the 08 Savvies, that is quite reductive now.
Mm-hmm.
And these are quite old wines by, you drink them young sort of approach. But one of the wines was a gold medal winner at the IWC.
Yep.
It came in, won lots of medals, tasted brilliantly. I loved it. Mm-hmm. And then now, year and a half, coming up to 2 years later, or over 2 years probably almost now, it's starting to go quite reductive.
Yep.
Is that a screw cap issue, or was it a problem with the winemaking initially?
Ultimately, it's probably an issue with the winemaking more so than the closure, but there's kind of a linkage there, and I can explain that. First off, the winemaking side, those ferments have probably been quite dirty at some stage. And
dirty
as in lots of hydrogen sulfide,
yep,
and other bad sulfur compounds that you don't want. And when you have those compounds, especially hydrogen sulfide, there's a real danger in exposing the young wine to a lot of oxygen or air, mm-hmm, because that will turn the hydrogen sulfide into a more complex form of smelly stuff, yep, if you like.
Well, like your garlics and your...
Exactly. Things called disulfides. And they actually aren't as smelly as hydrogen sulfide. So in effect, you can be oxidizing all of your hydrogen sulfide and turning it into disulfides. Mm-hmm. And then the smell seems to go away because they have a higher sensory threshold, yep, than hydrogen sulfide does. But they're still there. And that reaction is actually reversible over time. So if you put that into a bottle that has a good closure that doesn't let a lot of oxygen in, that reaction will actually reverse and the disulfides essentially snap in half and then turn into something else which is really smelly called a mercaptan.
Yep.
And then suddenly you've put a clean wine into bottle and then after a number of years or even sometimes months, depending on how bad the problem is, mm-hmm, you'll suddenly have a really stinky wine. And that, I would say, is what's going on there. And the linkage between the screw cap and that whole area of chemistry is that the screw cap with a Stelvin liner in it is a really effective barrier against oxygen, which is fantastic for looking after young, aromatic, fresh wines.
Yep.
And if you look at the numbers, they actually perform the same as a really good cork.
Yep.
Corks are natural products, so there's lots of variation within a batch of cork, and yep, some of those cork closures will perform the same way as a Stelvin. So I don't think you can necessarily blame the Stelvin for that.
Okay. It was the wine in the first place, so...
Yep, but a function of the closure that it's under, which is uniform in terms of its oxygen permeation,
yep,
tends to make this problem more apparent over time, because that really anaerobic or oxygen-free environment will then cause that reaction to shift back, and then you wind up with a lot of smelly stuff. Does that make
sense? Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. That's exactly brilliant.
It's quite an interesting area, and there's a lot of misunderstanding between screw caps and cork, and why is screw cap better than cork, or is cork better than screw cap? And I don't think there's any such thing as a perfect wine bottle closure.
Mm.
Like we talked about earlier, winemaking's all about a series of compromises. So it's a matter of balancing up what works best for your wines and looking at the benefits, like the pros and cons, and does that fit with what we're doing? But I mean, certainly to talk to the screw cap debate, for our wines, it makes a lot of sense. We want to protect those delicate aromas and have the wines landing fresh. But Siobhan was talking earlier about the work that we can do in the vineyard to make sure we don't have problems with low nitrogen level juices entering the winery.
Yep.
So those fermentations are easier to manage as a function of having higher levels of nitrogen. Yep. And then we have cleaner fermentations, then less problems with having to go back and do a whole lot of remedial winemaking work to correct issues that have happened,
yep,
during the ferment. And then ultimately we can put our wines to bottle under a screw cap and be quite confident that they're not going to get all smelly and reductive,
yeah,
no, over time. And I think if you look at Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc, it's made in quite of a like a tight fashion. It's nice and clean, especially when it's first released. It's quite tightly coiled, and it's a Sauvignon that I believe does age quite well. I had a 96 with Lynn Sheriff, Master of Wine, a while ago, and that was a beautiful wine, delicious wine, still very alive, very vibrant, fantastic. I think to drink Marlborough Sauvignon when it's made in that very fresh tank-fermented style as an older wine is a somewhat academic exercise, but the wines, I think it shows the pedigree of the wines, and I think not all Marlborough Sauvignons age as well as each other.
What about storage conditions? If it's too hot or anything like that, will that encourage any sulfur nose?
Not so much. It'll just rapidly accelerate the evolution of the wine.
So it'll speed up going that way?
Yes, yeah, or just speed up looking tired and dull and looking...
All right then, Tim and Siobhan, thank you very much.
Hope you enjoyed that. I'm so pleased I managed to record the show. I've known for a while that reduction can be caused by screw caps, or at least enhanced by it, but I didn't really understand how it happened. I find one of the easiest or quickest way to remove stink in the wine is to let it breathe a bit. A bit of oxygen goes a fair way to remove bottle stink, or reduction. I suppose if the molecules break apart to form the captains in the absence of oxygen, possibly they form back again when there's a bit of oxygen around. Not quite sure, I forgot to ask Tim about that, bit of a guess. For those of you who've told me, and I've had quite a few people tell me that they like the more technical shows, I hope this meets your requirements. I have a few more cracking techie shows like this recorded, but I'll put these out over the next wee while. Next week, while everybody in the UK wine scene is recovering from judging of various competitions, we're going to be looking at teeth. More importantly, what happens to your teeth when you drink wine and how you can protect them. Right, that pretty much ends the show. Obviously, we've got our mystery grape variety. Now, our mystery grape variety is Nebbiolo. It's a black grape variety which brings some of the finest and long-lived Italian wines. Native to Piedmont and the Northwest, it also makes top category DOCG wines of Barolo and Barbaresco in Piedmont. As I said last week, I'm not going to give you the full story about the grape variety again, but if you want to find out more about that grape variety, you can always go to our website 3050.co.uk and you should be able to find the notes on Nebbiolo there, or you should be able to just replay the podcast, I suppose. Just to finish up this week, as the first prices from the Bordeaux En Premier campaign are being released for 2009, this quote was said by an unknown American importer. It was actually in the book What Price Bordeaux that I'm reading for review. I should be finished hopefully next week, and we'll be reviewing that book next week, I hope. I've got about halfway through it so far. Anyway, the comment was, Bordeaux is about marks, dressed up as terroir. I find it pretty interesting, and I found the book very enlightening. So, until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott, and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.